Good evening. My name is Rebecca Fox, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. I would like to take a moment to acknowledge that we are gathered today in a place that lies within the traditional territories of the Susquehannock, the Shawnee, and the Lenape, indigenous peoples who inhabited this land for centuries prior to the arrival of European settlers. On behalf of the Clark Forum, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year, I am pleased to welcome you to tonight's panel discussion, Brexit: Where It Stands, What It Means. When the Clark Forum held a panel discussion on Brexit in 2016 after the referendum passed, the topics at hand were questions of what it meant for the future and when anything would come to pass. Now, in 2019, three prime ministers later, those questions and concerns persist. News from Parliament, the British Supreme Court, the Prime Minister, and more are released on a daily basis, indicating the unpredictability of the situation, both within the UK government and for Brexit overall. Eurosceptics, or those who oppose the EU, continue to push the nation to leave, whatever the cost. Those who oppose Brexit raise concerns for how losing the free movement of goods, services, and people throughout the EU will affect the economy and culture of Britain. When David Cameron, the Prime Minister, from 2010 to 2016, called the country to vote on EU membership, he did not anticipate the state of mistrust and unrest in the United Kingdom, as he's recently stated in his biography. The hope that leaving the Union would improve their economy, paired with the unrest at the prospect of new migrants coming into Britain due to the refugee crisis of the time, created a strong force of Britons who did not want to stay in the EU. As a dual citizen of England and America, I watched the unexpected events of 2016 unfold in both of my countries, and like many, felt unsure of what it meant for the future. I was confused on exactly what had happened and what the results would be, and it is difficult for me to answer these questions. I have seen firsthand this internal struggle of the British, who are also searching for answers in a time of uncertainty, answers that will specifically affect their future. As our panelists will discuss tonight, the results of Brexit and the October 31st deadline are likely to impact the economy, which would directly affect vulnerable populations. As the possible trading barriers between the UK and the EU solidify, there is a risk for increased prices, lower real wages, something which the Joseph Rowntree Foundation study has been analyzing. The Joseph Rowntree Foundation found that depending on the relationship formed after Brexit concludes, the British cost of living would increase between £150 and £450 per year. For people with lower incomes, this amount of money is substantial and is likely to increase the poverty rate in Britain. Additionally, the possible trade barriers could impact supplies of food and medicine, which would raise costs, affecting poorer communities first. I am now pleased to introduce our panelists. Mark Duckenfield is chair of the Department of National Security and Strategy at the U.S. Army War College, where he's been teaching since 2015. He has previously taught at the Air War College, the London School of Economics, and the University College London. He is the author of Business and the Euro, and he has written extensively on how politics and economics are intertwined. Duckenfield has given lectures across Europe and America on these topics. He received the Meritorious Civilian Service Award from the U.S. Air Force in 2015 for his exemplary service. Oya Dursun Özkanca is the endowed chair of the Department of International Studies and professor of political science at Elizabethtown College. She was also a visiting fellow of research on Southeastern Europe at the London School of Economics in 2013. Dursun Özkanca has written a number of scholarly articles in leading peer-reviewed journals, such as her paper, Turkey and the European Union, Strategic Partners or Competitors in the Western Balkans, published in the Journal of Regional Security in 2016. An op-ed she wrote for the Hurriyet Daily News was cited in NATO's online bibliography. Her book, titled Turkey-West Relations, The Politics of Intra-Alliance Opposition, is to be released in January of 2020. Ed Webb is Associate Professor of Political Science and International Studies at Dickinson College and has previously held assistant teaching positions at Haverford College and the University of Pennsylvania. He served in Britain's diplomatic service from 1992 to 2000, living and working in the Middle East and Europe. Webb is the author of Media in Egypt and Tunisia, From Control to Transition, and has published scholarly articles focusing on topics varying from modern education to economics and nationalism in the Middle East and Europe. A question and answer session will follow the lecture, so please hold all questions until then. The Clark Forum welcomes differences of opinions expressed politely, thoughtfully, and succinctly. Disruptive behavior or harassment of the speakers, members of the Dickinson community, or audience members will not be tolerated. As a show of respect for our speakers and everyone in attendance, please stay until the end of the program, including the question and answer session. At this time, I ask that you please silence all cell phones and other electronic devices. In the case of an emergency, please note that the handicapped accessible exits are located on the west side of the building. And now, please join me in welcoming our panelists.
Thank you very much, and my thanks to the Clark Forum for having all of us here. They've left our slides here, and I hope I will be able to put this up properly. Does that work for people? All right. I should say that my opinions here are my own, not those of the U.S. Army War College, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. Army. And it's good that I give you this disclaimer because I have some very strong opinions about this debacle of Brexit. I hope it won't preclude me from providing a broad and fair overview of the issues at play, but I wouldn't want to hide from you my dissatisfaction with the whole endeavor. Let's see. Oops. I think I'm going to have to manage this one by myself. So, I'm terribly sorry. And okay, now we're okay. Here's the European Union as it stands. And in large measure, the European Union is a space through which you can have a common trade policy. There are no barriers at the borders. Individuals can move between them without any impediments or border checks, as we're used to. So you could go from Lisbon all the way to Tallinn without going through border checks. And this is what the United Kingdom has been part of since the early 1970s. And this is what they've voted to leave and reclaim sovereignty over their internal regulations, their agriculture policy, their trade policy, all their various regulatory electricity policies, services, and goods. So this is what Britain is moving out of and what they're preparing to set up in the aftermath of being part of the European Union. But this is quite a major undertaking and one in which requires a great deal of negotiation and arrangements because now they'll have borders with people that had been and are their major trading partners. Now, this came about in part because of internal political divisions in Britain, particularly in the Conservative Party, which in the 2014 European elections performed very poorly. As you can see here, the Conservatives in blue were in third place, and a party that was not part of the mainstream parties, the UK Independence Party, UKIP, was the winner, if you will, with over a quarter of the vote on the right of the political spectrum. And this was a party that was anti-immigration, anti-European Union, and the Conservatives felt that this was making serious inroads into their electoral prospects, one that endangered their ability to hold on to power. Now, this proved to be relatively salient in 2015 when, while the Conservatives won the election, they barely got a majority. They needed 326 seats. They got 330 seats. And as you can see, the UK Independence Party got over 12% of the vote. So what could have been a very substantial Conservative majority turned into an extremely narrow one. And the Conservatives had promised a referendum in an effort to try and blunt the prospects of the UK Independence Party. And this proved to be rather a major mistake because the UK government didn't want to leave the European Union. What the Conservatives wanted to do was get rid of the UK Independence Party. And if they thought they could win an election, stay in the European Union, then the UK Independence Party, they could say, solved your problem, go away. But it didn't work out that way. They ended up losing the election, and the British population confronted with the sort of icky reality of the European Union with all its complications of any government, with the idealized prospects of leaving, voted narrowly to leave the European Union, and the government determined to honor this. Now, in part, much of this was the internal dynamics of the Conservative Party, and a critique has been made that they're sort of out of touch, the leadership with the population, that they had a disproportionate number of people from the upper classes and the elites, which the UK Independence Party and populists had run against. And in particular, David Cameron, the Prime Minister, was referred to as a posh boy who had gone to Eton along with Boris Johnson, the current Prime Minister. Eton's a British private school. It's sort of the Slytherin house of British private schools. Which, actually, if you think about it, Boris Johnson's sort of a cross between Dudley Dursley and Draco Malfoy, then you can see that's probably not going to end well, right? And, of course, it did not. I think not really since the days of Roger Taney and James Madison has one small school been so responsible for a national calamity as Eton was in this case. So they voted to leave. Now, what does leave mean? Well, there are lots of different models of not being in the European Union, and I've put a bunch of them up here of neighbors and countries that have different sorts of arrangements with the European Union. And different people could pick and choose and say, well, we like these arrangements or we like these others. If you were Turkey, you know, they have a customs union with Britain, so Turkey doesn't negotiate its own trade policy. It takes whatever the European Union has. But Turkey can't move free. Turkish people can't move freely to and fro the EU. They aren't subject to the European Court of Justice. They don't contribute financially to the EU. So that's one model. The Norwegians, the Swiss, the Ukrainians all have other models, and people could pick and choose which of these they liked based upon what their priorities are. Now, the Conservatives wanted it to be a sort of Canadian-South Korean model where you're out of everything, but you have a special trade agreement with the European Union, which they don't have at the moment. And that would, you know, perhaps be one that would satisfy those criteria. The problem is, within the British Parliament, there's not a majority for any single one of these. People could perhaps agree, as the electorate did, that they didn't want to remain inside the European Union, but which of these they would choose is up in the air. And so this poses a certain degree of problems for the British Parliament as they seek to leave and for British prime ministers. So here was and so Theresa May, who became prime minister after David Cameron, sought to create a strong, stable government that could, you know, firmly deliver one of these options, that they could pass it through parliament. But it turned out to be even worse for her. Here's the 2017 general election. And you can see the UK Independence Party is, you know, obliterated, 1.8%, and the Conservatives go up, but so does the Labour Party, so do the Scottish Nationalists, and you can see how parties like the Scottish Nationalists, the Liberal Democrats, and others, their vote maps pretty closely with the votes of people who voted to remain. So the Conservatives end up with 317 seats, which is shy of the 326 seats they need for a majority. And this leads them into an area that no British politician really wants to go to for the mainstream parties. They have to make a deal with the Irish. And the Irish, always the bane of the London politician, have their own, you know, issues that they deal with between the Protestants who want to be deeply embedded with the United Kingdom and the Catholics who want to be part of the Southern Irish Republic. So, and they believe these things very strongly. Here's the leader of the former leader of the Democratic Unionist Party at the European Parliament protesting John Paul II, the Antichrist. And this was, you know, this was the sort of, so they believe these things quite strongly. But they've been able to come up with an agreement within the framework of the European Union where there weren't borders between the UK and Ireland, and so Northerners could go back and forth, and Catholics in Northern Ireland could have Irish passports, and everyone was, you know, a happy European together. But that wouldn't be the case in a Brexit Britain. So here's the government party, the Conservatives of Theresa May and now Boris Johnson, and they have 317 after the election. They need 326. So they make a deal with the Democratic Unionist Party. That gets them just over the threshold, but not by very much. It makes them very vulnerable. And then you start looking at the internal dynamics of the Conservative Party. They've got 90 hardcore, or 90 Euroskeptics, at least 30 of whom are hardcore. They don't want any arrangement that would have any connection to European institutions. They don't want a common customs area. They don't want free movement. For them, it's Brexit or bust. They need to be out. And the and backstops for Ireland and temporary arrangements is not what they signed up for. They want completely out. Now, the other side, they had a by-election. The Conservatives lost. Then three independent members defected. Then someone else defected while Boris Johnson was making his first speech as prime minister. Then 21 members voted against the government and were suspended. One person resigned from the cabinet. In fact, the prime minister's brother resigns from the cabinet and leaves. So it makes the black family permutations look soft in comparison. So this is a group that is very much against Brexit. And you can see at this point, there's not really a parliamentary majority for what Boris Johnson wants to do. And in fact, Parliament, the opposition parties, seize control of the agenda and pass a law that says you cannot leave without an agreement. There can be no hard Brexit, a Brexit where you're just out with no agreement and you default to the same arrangements that any country that doesn't have any existing trade agreement or other agreement with the European Union would have. I think Ed will talk more about this later, but Boris Johnson attempted to use some of the Queen's powers to make to suspend Parliament temporarily, that he was going to put them out of talking and debating so that he could get his no deal through while Parliament was out. The British Supreme Court ruled 11-0 that this was unlawful, but in the sort of the machinations they make, the Queen can't act unlawfully. However, her ministers could give her unlawful advice. And so the advice that the Queen in good faith took was unlawful and hence not valid. So Parliament was summoned back, and Boris Johnson was unable to get that through, which leaves us with the circumstance we're in now, where the big problem remains Ireland. And if you're in Northern Ireland, which is, Ireland's one island, and if you put up a hard border there, then if you're thinking about your Irish identity and you're a Catholic in Northern Ireland, well, that's a pretty clear emphasis that you're not, that sovereignty lies somewhere other than with you and you're not part of the Irish Republic, whatever you think. On the other hand, if you're a Protestant and a Unionist, if, Ireland, Northern Ireland stays as part of Ireland with arrangements that are still within the EU customs union and still within the economic arrangements, that might economically work, but it sort of implies you're not really part of the United Kingdom. So that doesn't work for you either. Now, one could say that what really works is the European Union and that it papered over these differences and it managed to avoid these very hard and difficult choices. But economically, especially in the border regions of Ireland, this is quite problematic. If you were the Guinness Corporation, you create your Guinness in Dublin, and then you ship it up to be bottled in Belfast. And if there's a border there, you have to go through health and safety checks. And then you send it back to be labeled. And then you send it back to be sold. You're crossing the border multiple times. This is pretty inconvenient and can be quite devastating for the communities and jobs on which this depends. So it creates a quandary about where you go, and this has been one of the big struggles that they've yet been able to resolve, what sort of temporary arrangements you might have, and are these temporary arrangements ones that you either opt into, which the Ulster Protestants would like, that after, say, 4 years, unless you opt in, you're out, or do you have to explicitly opt out and win a referendum in Ireland, say, in which case the Catholics like that because they could probably win that referendum. So what the default option is matters a great deal, and you'd want to be able to go with, be able to set that in place. Now, We just had a parliamentary election in Europe, and a new party that was very dissatisfied, it was from the remnants of the UK Independence Party, ran candidates. And they said, well, look, you know, what part of Leave don't you understand? We voted for Leave, get us out. And they win this election. Again, you can see how the vote for the Brexit Party maps on to the vote for the people who voted Remain. But by the same token, you can see how anti-Brexit parties, like in Scotland, the Nationalist Party, or in Wales, or in areas around London, voted the other way. And intriguingly, the parties that support a referendum on whatever agreement has come up with, whether it's a customs union or a hard Brexit, they got about 53% of the vote. So while the plurality go to the Brexit party that says, we want out now, you do have parties that want to have at least a look at what the agreement is getting majority. Now, of course, Boris Johnson's learned from David Cameron. He doesn't want to have an election that he might lose and be forced into something he doesn't want, staying in the European Union. So he's very adamant not to have such a referendum. Now, with that, I think I'll turn my time over to Ed, and we can proceed after that to Oya and have your questions.
Nope. Now, yes? Anyone hear anything? I can project if I have to. So I'd rather not be here. Let me explain this. I have no objection speaking to students and the community. I love to do that. But what I mean by that is a couple of things. One, I'm here in some senses as a substitute. My colleague Christine Mitchell is the true expert on European politics at Dickinson. But she's on sabbatical this year, so you get the substitute, I'm afraid. The other reason for this, and I'll explain in a minute why I do know a little bit about the subject, but not as much as my colleagues here. The other reason is I'm really tired. Like Rebecca, I'm connected both to the United States and the United Kingdom, and these last 3 years have been really quite exhausting. And I'm saying this not because I want your sympathy, although I'll take it, but because this actually has a political effect, right? The population of the United Kingdom is exhausted at this point, right? They want something, anything, right? The Conservative Party or Tory Party, both names fit. The official name's Conservatives, but you'll hear reference to Tories, same thing. Tory Party conference is just taking place in the United Kingdom. The Prime Minister gave his address to conference today, I think. And the slogan on all the banners inside and outside the conference hall and everything else is "Get Brexit done," right? So that's the slogan, right? And it's tapping into a feeling people care passionately about this issue, but more than anything else, they want it to stop, is my reading. 40% of British residents in a recent poll reported mental health fallout from Brexit. That their mental health had been adversely affected by this whole process that Mark just set out for you. I'm actually surprised it's only 40%, but maybe some people are finding a way to tune it out. Maybe people are underreporting. I don't know. But I think we should take that seriously. The population is tired of this stuff. That exhaustion favors the Prime Minister. That favors those who want to get Brexit done, however they get it done. But it's a dangerous thing democratically, right? In a healthy democracy, you need citizens to be engaged, to be paying attention, to be expressing themselves, to be active. This sort of thing, exhaustion of a population, actually is something that tends to push in a more authoritarian direction. Now, let me be clear. I'm not saying that the United Kingdom is about to become an authoritarian or a hybrid regime or anything like that. But that's a tendency. People want this done, and that means people may stop paying attention, pressuring MPs, and so on. Now, I told you I'm not Christine Mitchell, who would be the better person to be sitting in this seat. What can I bring to this? I'm directly affected by this. I follow this closely. It matters to me. It actually affects my life. A referendum that I could not vote in 2016 may... Odds at the moment are about 3-1 against, but we don't know, may actually take away part of my citizenship status. Right? I will if Brexit happens, I will no longer be a European citizen. And for me and for many others, that's quite important. And for those of us living abroad, if you've been living abroad more than 15 years, and I have, we didn't get to vote in the referendum. So, I follow this stuff, I care about this stuff, but from a lay perspective. From a more social scientific perspective, I am a specialist in comparative politics. My region is actually not this one. I study West Asia or the Middle East, North Africa, other parts of Africa. I study mainly authoritarian systems, but also transitions to democracy and sometimes away from democracy. So I can talk in a bit of a comparative perspective about some of what we've seen. So I'm just going to pick a few things out of how we got to where we are today and why it might matter. The first thing I want to talk about is the political parties. You've just had a breakdown of how things have changed over the last few years. Populism and the referendum itself in 2016. Let's start with populism. Populism is different from democracy, right? Populism is a direct appeal to the authority of the people, but usually is actually coming from an elite claiming that authority without actually having recourse to find out what the people want, right? We see that for whatever reason, and there is some interesting discussion, and maybe when we get to Oyo, we'll get into this a bit more, we see a rise of populism among many Western democracies at the moment, right? We see these direct appeals around the institutions, around the formal institutions of governance and consulting the people, and direct appeals, the rise of strongman leaders in various countries in Europe and elsewhere. So, Nigel Farage, for example, the leader first of UKIP, active in the Brexit Party, is someone who has found a way to tap into discontent and channel that into claiming a certain type of mandate, and clearly is successful as a political entrepreneur, right? The numbers that Mark just showed you for election results, particularly the European election, show that he's had a big impact. But there are other populists in the mix too. Alexander Boris de Pfeffel Johnson is his name, right? Goes by Boris because it's cuddlier somehow, approachable, right? Do not be fooled by Boris. Boris is a personality for media consumption and public consumption, right? And he's tweaked this and honed it over a few decades, right? He's been part of performing this long before he was even mayor of London, although he did it in that role too. But he is very ambitious. He's entirely an opportunist. I'd actually quarrel with something Mark said when he said something about what the Prime Minister wants. The Prime Minister wants something different every 10 minutes, right? Boris Johnson essentially will do whatever it takes to get whatever bit of power he can. And you know, his own family have told us, you know, he's a pathological liar. Right? You expect him to lie. His sister has told us this publicly and others. His own brother resigned from the cabinet. The people who know him best, David Cameron in this new book, I refuse to buy it, but the excerpts that have been published, right, does not paint a picture of Boris as a principled person pursuing a particular vision of Britain's place in Europe or out of Europe. Right? And in fact, he's taken positions on both sides of that debate at different times. But he has been involved for a long time in spreading certain ideas about the European Union, what it is and what it isn't. He was Brussels correspondent for a number of years for a British publication and became known among the Brussels press corps as someone who would write, just make things up, right? He would write about some plausible sounding new regulation from the EU about straight bananas or something like this, right? And it played very well for the public, right? I'm going to talk in a moment about the media and their role in all of this, and we need to think about why those stories worked so well. In that populist vein, we should also think about people like Stephen Yaxley Lennon. You may know him, if you know him at all, as Tommy Robinson. So again, there's a lot of name-changing going on, right? Tommy Robinson is on the far right of British politics. He's been involved with violent British nationalist organizations. He has been imprisoned several times for contempt of court. He has a wide support among the transatlantic alt-right and far-right. But again, he's part of the same ecosystem where populist figures are finding a niche and making their mark in politics. And the murder of Joe Cox MP in the run-up to the election was one of the worst aspects of this shift in politics, away from debate and systems of elections and these things to violence as a means of solving disputes. And we're back in that now. The current climate in Britain, parliamentarians begging the Prime Minister to change his tone, reporting the death threats they're getting. Those who don't support Brexit are getting death threats from their constituents and others. Prime Minister shows no intention of changing his rhetoric. In fact, he's amped it up. Right? This is dangerous stuff. Okay, political parties. Essentially, what you saw here leading up to David Cameron's decision to call this referendum is actually the result of at least a 40-year civil war in the Conservative Party over Europe. Interestingly enough, probably one of the most important architects of the European Union as it exists today is Margaret Thatcher, who pushed in the 1980s for a single European Act, for the creation of a single market, and she represented in that a part of the Conservative Party that saw opportunities for business and saw in the in an enhanced single market across the EU a lot of opportunities for Britain. But she never brought the whole of the party with her. She was always facing resistance from the more nationalist, nativist type wing of the party. That has now expressed itself in splinters, such as new parties, the dissolution of the party in Parliament, and so on. But it's not just the Conservatives. Right? The Labour Party, we essentially have a two-party system in the UK due to the electoral system. The Labour Party also doesn't have a clear view of what it wants. It is more pro-Remain than it is pro-Leave, but there are different factions, and the current leader, Jeremy Corbyn, and many people who support him are actually more in favour of leaving than remaining. The idea that if they can get out from European Union regulation, they'll be able to implement socialism in one country, essentially. Right? A very traditional democratic socialist agenda of nationalisation of certain public services, saving the National Health Service from privatisation, bringing the railways back under national control, and those sorts of things. That has a fairly large constituency, but that's not all of the Labour Party either. The Liberal Democrats are resolutely pro-Europe, but they lost a lot of credibility for working with the Tory government in coalition before. They've been out in the wilderness. Now they're now on the upswing again, but no one can really tell what they're for. They say we won't support a Corbyn government, but we don't want Brexit, and you know, who knows what's going on with them. And so on. The point is there's been a lot of shake-up in politics, right, across the parties. Some of it could be healthy, right? Sometimes you get parties kind of stuck in a certain thing, so this vigorous internal debate could be healthy, right? But we also see these populist tendencies and the violence and these other things, and these are not healthy. The referendum. Okay, referendums are not part of the British system of government, traditionally. They're not well understood even as part of the system of government. The system of government in the United Kingdom is about parliamentary sovereignty. So putting things directly to the people in a referendum is always a huge gamble, doesn't get done very often for good reasons, and yet in the past few years we had the Scottish independence referendum, the Brexit referendum, and now calls for a second referendum on whatever deal does or doesn't get done. This is a very strange way traditionally to do politics in Britain, and so far it doesn't seem to be very effective. Particularly given what I started with, given how exhausted everyone is. You're going to drag us to the polls yet again after all these elections and this referendum and that referendum, and now you want us to... I'm not sure it's going to go that well, right? Even if those who want a second referendum, and they have good reasons to ask for it, actually get what they want. It's still a huge gamble and a huge unknown. All right, last things I want to say are about the Constitution. The United Kingdom does have a Constitution. It's not written down. You can't read it in a simple document and learn it the way you can here or in many other countries, but it does have one. It's made up of a patchwork of laws, traditions, practices, institutions. And we've seen it severely tested recently. The queen held hostage in that cartoon, the decision of the Supreme Court, unanimous decision of the Supreme Court, itself a constitutional innovation, didn't exist 20 years ago, but unanimous decision that the Prime Minister had misled the Queen and therefore Parliament should sit again. All these things are entirely unprecedented. Constitutional lawyers did not know which way the Supreme Court was going to go at all. And yet, when it was announced, 10:30, where was it? Last Tuesday? I don't know. That's how we live now. You know, a unanimous decision that essentially the Prime Minister had misled the Queen in sending Black Rod into Parliament and dragging the Speaker out in this ancient tradition, which is all very amusing on C-SPAN, but actually has severe consequences for the efficient running or not of the country. Parliament is sovereign in the United Kingdom. That is the tradition of government established by a civil war, which was extremely violent and led Hobbes to write a book that's, you know, some of you may be familiar with, Leviathan, saying, I don't like this very much. Let's not have any more civil wars. And so we haven't since then. Well, then we had a glorious revolution, imported some monarchs from the Netherlands because they would allow Parliament to be sovereign in a way that wasn't up to that point. It really matters. That's the core of the US Constitution, the British Constitution, right? The Parliament is sovereign, the Queen is head of state, but Parliament is where decisions get made. So when the Prime Minister said, actually, we don't need Parliament to sit for the next few weeks, right, in this critical period running up to the 31st of October, this was more outrageous than you can probably sense from this side of the Atlantic. This was essentially saying, Constitution doesn't matter too much. I'm Prime Minister now, selected by about 100,000 members of the Conservative Party, and I get to choose whether Parliament even discusses things or not. This is really... So there's a good reason why there was a backlash from Parliament and the court case and the decision. And we get to this point, and we get to a Parliament that cannot decide, right? Because there's no majority for any of these things, because the referendum itself and the impossible promises made by the Leave campaign during the referendum campaign, you know, have put us in a position where there is no majority for any of the possible solutions. You saw all this. There's a whole menu of possible ways for the UK to leave or not leave. But there's no majority for any single one of those in Parliament. So what do you do? Well, we'll have an election. That would make sense, right? Based on what you've just seen, do you think that will solve things? Do you think you'll get a Parliament that can now sort of decide? No, right? Because these things are just not good. I would say the courts, the High Court, Supreme Court, have acquitted themselves well constitutionally. I would say the media have been desperately bad at doing their constitutional job. And this is the point I'm ending on. The media, if you take them seriously as the fourth estate, as part of governance, have been very irresponsible on European affairs and the European Union for decades. I mentioned the Prime Minister's background in being part of that, but he's far from alone. The tabloid newspapers in Britain, which are opinion formers and shapers in particular, the broadcast media are more regulated, and so they have to be a little more careful, but the print media in Britain have been selling all sorts of fake news, right, about the European Union for decades. Right? And why not? It sells newspapers, and the European Union is complicated, it's pretty boring, understanding this stuff, you know. So, you understand why it sells newspapers. But the end result is you have an underinformed, sometimes misinformed, occasionally actively disinformed population being asked to sort out these things because the politicians can't sort it out for themselves. So David Cameron says, let's have a referendum. That's how to solve this. This was the worst possible question to put to the people, right? Because the people don't understand the European Union. And that sounds horribly elitist, but let me tell you, my first job in the British Diplomatic Service was working on European Union affairs, and I did that for about 18 months, and by about month 17, I began to understand the bit of European Union business that I was responsible for. It is exceptionally complicated, and it's therefore very hard, even if you're pro-EU, to explain to people why it's a good thing, what it does for people. right? And so it's very easy for the populists to come up and say, no, it's bad. It wants to take away your curved bananas or your traditional British sausages or whatever it is people are attached to at that particular moment and sell some vision of a return to something less foreign, right? So there's plenty of blame to go around for the mess we're in, and whether you think Britain should be in the EU or not, you cannot be satisfied with the current situation, with where we find ourselves in October 2019, right? 3.5 years after that referendum, right? But if I'm going to point to the major villains here, right, David Cameron certainly is high up the list, right, for being spineless and making a very, very silly decision, right? But I would say the media, particularly the print media, also are pretty near the top of people we should be pointing at for where we find ourselves today. With that, oh yeah.
Thank you very much. So, those of you who were hoping to hear a diehard pro-Brexit type of an opinion at the end of the panel will be severely disappointed. So let me start by saying that, and as a Turk, it is quite inconceivable to me that Turks have been trying to get a part of, become a part of European Union since 1959, and with one referendum, the Brits are done away with this, so that's quite inconceivable to me as a pro-EU membership Turkish-American scholar. So I'm here today to put Brexit in more international context, and we are going to be talking about the international implications of Brexit. So yes, we have seen the same statistics by Dr. Deckenfield, and here you can see the most important result here. Is Northern Ireland and Scotland, they voted primarily, predominantly, to remain within the European Union, but here they are, dragged together with the rest of the UK, dragged out of the European Union. So that really raises a number of discontent within the UK and quite detrimental for the unity of the United Kingdom as well. And here is a similar type of a map that Dr. Deckenfield has already provided. So we have seen, you know, pockets of support for Remain, but then we have seen predominantly, leave, pro-leave places in the UK map. And the mechanics of delivering Brexit, so this is a very nice compliment to my co-panelists here, because Dr. Deckenfield provided the major timelines and the possible scenarios for the future of the UK's relationship with the EU, and Dr. Ed Webb has talked about the internal processes touching upon the institutional responses and opportunism and populism that comes with the discussions with regards to Brexit. And here I am talking about the international implications. But first of all, let's talk about the referendum itself. So once the referendum was held, and it was quite unexpected for everyone, the UK government itself was quote unexpected and unprepared to respond to this small margin pro-Brexit outcome of the referendum. So it took them by surprise. They took the time to invoke Article 50 in order to start the process to withdraw from the European Union. And just so you know, from a legal perspective, EU law still stands until the UK withdraws from the European Union. UK will continue to abide by the EU treaties and laws, their decision-making is going to be limited in the time being. So the negotiated agreement, if there is any, would need to be adopted by a qualified majority of 72% of the remaining 27 member states of the European Union, representing 65% of the population. So once that is done, approved, then you will see the final approval by the European Parliament, voting by a simple majority. So that's the process of delivering the Brexit. And just so you know, in the last decades, the UK law has been harmonized in order to comply with the acquis communautaire, the 80,000 pages of EU agreements, treaties, over the course of these decades of UK's membership into the European Union. So it will take quite some time, energy and effort in order to untackle these laws and, UK moving on in its own direction. So Britain can't make formal trade deals, for instance, with other countries until the EU divorce has been completed. So establishing new ties actually require them to, first of all, break up from the European Union, which means that it is going to add a time crunch to all the post-Brexit, if it happens. I'm an eternal optimist, so I'm still hoping that a miracle is going to happen and UK won't leave the European Union. But leaving optimism aside, it will really provide an intensive amount of time crunch for the UK to engage in new sets of relationship, especially trade relationships, so that life won't be paralyzed, especially for economic purposes. So the advocates of Brexit have argued that it will have little impact on the UK's international standing or economy. However, it looks like by all analyses, you can see that it will have significant diplomatic and economic implications for both parties involved, UK and the European Union. So UK's diplomatic weight will be certainly diminished, at least temporarily, in the short to medium run, because all of their energy, all of their investment, time investment, is going to be predominantly allocated to figuring out where the UK stands in the world, especially in terms of international trade, in terms of its relations with the European Union. It is a significant endeavor that will take up significant amount of time and energy. And adding to that, we will need, as a security scholar, perhaps new venues for intra-European military defense cooperation that would involve UK's relationship with the rest of the European Union nation states. And this may lead some to conclude that perhaps NATO is going to regain some more significance for the European security. Not that it wasn't important, but with the UK outside of the European Union, we can perhaps envision that NATO is going to gain a much more important role in the European security. Perhaps the UK will be more willing to signify communicate with the rest of the European Union that we are here, we want to be a part of the European security as well. Needless to say, the Brexit itself represents a heavy blow to any type of multilateralism in global affairs. We have been seeing a lot of this recently in relation to what Dr. Webb has been talking about, this populism wave and this anti-globalization, anti-globalism, anti-multilateralism trends that we are seeing. No doubt Brexit is certainly contributing to that wave. And At one point in time, people were very worried that this Brexit is going to create a precedent where other Eurosceptical European Union member states are going to follow suit and they will try to leave the European Union. But I think we are pretty safe to conclude that because of all the headache that we have been experiencing, I don't think that it is in the very best interest of these Eurosceptical countries to initiate some sort of a withdrawal from the European Union. And let me tell you, we haven't started to see the type of, you know, mess that is going to come out of Brexit once it happens, if it happens. So this is nothing. Dr. Webb talked about the psychological burden that it has placed on many citizens of the UK. However, I'm afraid the future is not that optimistic, and we are probably going to see more of a disappointment, anxieties, problems with the supply chains, all sorts of practical implications for the citizens there as well. And like I was saying, we will see renegotiation of the free trade agreements with between the European Union, that were concluded by the European Union with about 60 non-European Union countries, third parties. So we are going to see the UK renegotiating these trade agreements, which means essentially less priority given to any other issues, because you have limited personnel, officials that are dealing with these negotiations. Think about the Foreign Service and what type of an energy it needs to be redirecting towards the negotiation of FTA. So this will be a significant burden. And also for the unity within the UK, we have heard debates within Scotland to ask for a second referendum, because in 2014 we have seen Scotland voting in favour of remaining within the UK. However, given that they have voted predominantly to stay within the European Union, remain, we can see that the independence cause gaining more traction. And also, there are questions about Britain's role in the as a financial center, especially London's role as a global financial center. Especially without access to the single market, can it retain that status? What about the Northern Ireland situation? Dr. Duckenfield has referred to the Irish backstop. How are you going to deal with the possibility of a hard border between Northern Ireland and Ireland? This will prove to be very paralyzing for trade and inflow of supplies of any type of things. Hence the situation right now, the panic situation of people actually storing up as much commodities as possible before Brexit happens, just in case that supply is not flowing in the UK. And also, on top of all this, if you are not depressed enough, there is the status of about 1 billion Brits living abroad in the European Union. What will happen to their residency rights and access to free emergency health care, for instance, as a result of their EU citizenship? And also the status of over 3 million European Union citizens living in the UK, what will happen to them? And in the past couple of months, we have slowly seen qualified working force from the EU member states leaving the UK, which is creating certain shortages in certain professional lines. So this is going to be proving itself as a major challenge for the job market in the UK. And the Irish backstop has been the center of attention for the negotiations that were negotiated, the withdrawal agreement negotiated by Theresa May with the European Union. Yesterday I was reading anonymous resources from the European Commission saying that they may give concessions to the UK and say that, okay, we will do a temporary situation with the backstop until you come up with some sort of a trade arrangement with the European Union. So we don't know yet because Boris Johnson has not submitted the official request for on that topic yet. So increasingly hard no-deal Brexit seems more likely. However, you never know how things will turn out to be. As Dr. Webb has pointed out, there is so much uncertainty going on. What is once said yesterday is being rejected the next day. So there is a lot of uncertainty in the air. And also from the European Union's perspective, the goal is to make sure that whatever the new type of an agreement, whatever type of an agreement is negotiated, it won't be too friendly to the Europe, to the United Kingdom, so that it won't open the gates of possibilities for other Eurosceptic countries to initiate similar types of processes. So Interlaken principles of 1987 says actually regulates relations with non-member states. And it says that EU will always prioritize its own internal interests, and EU will always safeguard its own decision-making autonomy, and non-members will have no say even if they are obliged to implement the EU's decision. For instance, Dr. Duckenfield has referred to Turkey's customs union agreement, which is absolutely right, that Turkey has no decision-making authority and it is bound legally to follow the terms of the agreement that is negotiated with the third parties, between the EU and the third parties. So that really takes away the decision-making autonomy from non-member states. And also, any relationship must be based on balance of benefits and obligations with these non-member states. By that, they mean basically that the EU's interests will be actually prioritized. So having said that, and having no precedent of any other country leaving the European Union, with the exception of a territory, Greenland, back in 1985, we don't know what this process would entail, so we are all really witnessing to a very historic moment in the history of the European Union or Western civilization, if you will. So there are a lot of unknowns that are ingrained in the process. So what the UK and the EU needs to do is to set aside, especially in the last couple of 2 years or so, a lot of uncertainties, disagreements, and tensions in their bilateral relationship, and move past that. Because let's not forget, it was quite a win-win situation for both parties, and not only from an economic standpoint, but also from a security standpoint as well. So the terrorist threat, for instance, will be no less with Brexit. And Britain needs to make sure, the UK needs to make sure that they have a continued working relationship with the EU partners to ensure the stability, safety of the European continent. So, for instance, Schengen Information System, which is the largest information sharing system for security and border management in Europe. We don't know what will happen. Will UK remain as a part of SIS, or will they stay out of it? So this will have major implications for European security. And from a trade perspective, UK imports from the EU about 341 billion. The trade volume is that, and the UK exports to the EU is 260 billion. If there is no agreement, everyone suffers, because it was a win-win situation. About 50% of the UK exports are to the European Union. So if there is no agreement, anticipate shortages of fuel, food, medicine, and also long lines in the at the border, and the tariffs that the corporations that are dealing with international trade between the UK and the other European Union member states, they will have to prepare for this, but it is an impossible task to do. All of a sudden, with the snap of a finger, you cannot get ready for tariffs. Having lived most of your past decades under a tariff-free system, so there are high stakes for all parties involved. In conclusion, and as Dr. Webb has pointed out, I was going to talk about populism aspect as well, but maybe we can talk about it in the Q&A section. But we really have recognized the need to have better informed public. And as you have pointed out, Webb, Ed, the European Union does not perhaps do a good job of educating its citizens as to what they do, in fact. I have a lot of European students that take my European Union class, and they tell me as a result of taking the class, they are like, now we know what the EU does. But, I mean, you don't have to come to the US to take a class to understand what the EU does and how it functions. So that is quite problematic. And we need to have in the... we need to remember that there is a need to have a well-functioning bilateral relationship between the UK and the European Union. Thank you very much.
Should we go straight to questions?
So I think we'll just open it up to questions since we have about half an hour left.
Yep. Since the event's being recorded, please wait for the mic to reach you before asking your question. And also, as an undergraduate institution, we'll reserve the first questions for students. We'll now take the first question.
Hey, my name is Abudi Roman. I'm a senior here. I had a question for Professor Webb. You talked about media's role in Brexit and how they've amplified this kind of exhaustion. Can you like specify on specific media cells? Like, I'm presuming you're referring to the Murdoch Group, Evening Standard, Daily Mail, or are you just talking about across the board?
I would say, I'll say two things. There are certainly, you can identify publications as broadly Eurosceptic or pro-EU, and you've been able to do that for a few decades now. Occasionally, one of them switches sides. The Daily Mail and the Sunday Mail never seem to agree on anything, and so they sometimes switch back and forth. The Evening Standard under George Osborne actually has flipped, I think, towards pro-EU now. It's hard to follow. But many of them, certainly the Murdoch-owned newspapers, from the very trashiest up to the at least one time respectable Times, really it's not as good as it was. But they have pushed a skeptical line on EU, and sometimes that's, there's nothing wrong with skepticism. You don't have to be excited about the European project. But as I say, there's actually been a lot of misinformation and occasional active disinformation, and not just on the opinion pages, right? Particularly the tabloids. If you go back to as far as the 80s and 90s, you would have stories about regulation that the EU was apparently going to ban something, stop people drinking pints or whatever, and occasionally there'd be something to it. Sometimes there'd be something to it, but it'd been misconstrued in a particular way, and sometimes there was nothing to it at all. It'd just been essentially invented. So I think that, yeah, but I would say across the board, right, the EU is hard to explain, right? You can go to E-Town, a very high-quality institution, and take a course, and you can learn about it, all right? Well, when Professor Mitchell gets back, you can take a course here and learn about it. But ordinary citizens don't understand it. And when I've talked to my own family members, they don't really understand it. Some of them do. It tends to be the people who understand the EU tend to be those who work with it in some way or other. They're in government, or they're in a quasi-non-governmental agency, or they work in business, or so on, right? They have reason to understand at least part of what the EU does. But ordinary everyday citizens don't have any particular need to and have never been told why they should pay attention to this. And therefore, it's very easy to confuse them. And the Leave campaign, as we've seen in retrospect, I mean, at the time it was obvious to some, it's become obvious to even more afterwards, the Leave campaign was actively promoting lies, right? And they got away with it. But if you have an informed public, it's harder to do that, right? But the media, right across the board, I'd include the broadcast media, who are more tightly regulated, but the BBC and the rest, have never done a good job of explaining to ordinary citizens what the EU is, why it matters. And I think there's fairly good evidence that that is replicated across the European Union, right? This is not a peculiar British thing, right? The French public, the Danish public, the Hungarian public, the Italian public, most of them are not well informed as a general matter about the European Union. And yes, the European Union itself does not have a good communication strategy, but the media has been, you know, really a problem, I would say.
I think it's been established that this is horribly depressing and exhausting, but what is good about Brexit? Like, why are people thinking that this could be good? Why is it that they've managed to bamboozle the entire public that this is going to be a great thing?
I could say a few things if you want.
Yeah, I mean, I would say part of it is that it enables you to project all of your problems onto foreigners, which the British are not unique in this. They love doing it. I mean, they hate Johnny Foreigner, but they're not the, you know, everyone's like this, right? So it enables you to do that. And you can sort of sell a fantasy of what life will be out without, you know, being shackled to, you know, Europe, which is largely a German-run racket anyway, and that's the particular foreigner the British don't like. And so you can get out there and say, well, we'll
be... like any of them.
Yeah, they don't like any of them, but yeah, but the Germans in particular. So you get out there and you say, well, you know, they're what's holding us back from trading well. They're the ones that are, you know, we could be really dynamic and so forth, and we could cut our own way and be, you know, agile and quick. And now, of course, Britain's not agile and quick and was always heavily bureaucratized and whatever. But nonetheless, that was what they could argue, and that these, you know, these slow processes in Europe could, and in some cases they would be ones that, you know, European agreements might privilege, say, agriculture somewhat more than a British government would. There's not a big agricultural sector in the United Kingdom. There's much more of one on the continent, and so common agriculture policy would be more beneficial. So you could pick and choose. Now, by the same token, there are things that benefit Britain. Britain's got a huge financial center, so getting access to all of European finance is great for some people in Britain. But if, you know, if you feel your job's under threat and you think East Europeans are coming in and cutting your wages, you could see that, you know, and if you think that, you know, if you want to make Britain great again, and this is, you know, it's a slogan that predated, I think, the American version by several decades, that there's a sort of hearkening back to when you could, and again, there's not, it's a sort of golden age that never was, but, you know, when you didn't have to lock the door to your house and things like that, that this would return. And that's how you sell it. And those would be some, you know, some of the advantages, one could say.
I'm going to try and be pro-Brexit for a moment to answer your question. I mean, there's definitely this sort of affective dimension, this nostalgia. We lost the empire. We're terribly sad about it, you know. And but to be a little more pragmatic or practical or materialist about it, right, the short answer probably is regulation, right? The European Union regulates a lot of things, right? It may not regulate your breakfast sausage, but it's probably regulating some aspect of it, right? Even if there's no sausage regulation, there are food additive regulations, there are other things, right? So, there's a sort of a right Brexit, right-wing Brexit, which is we need to unshackle business and the entrepreneurial spirit, and if we get rid of all these environmental and labor and standards regulations of different types, we will be able to unleash the genius of the economy Adam Smith stuff, right? And that's, you know, that's not ridiculous at all, right? The EU does have an awful lot of regulations. There are businesses, right, and there are business sectors in the UK that feel they don't get that much out of EU membership, right? It varies a lot by sector. The tech sector, I just saw a survey today, 71% of the major high-tech firms say they're going to get damaged quite a lot by Brexit, right? But that's one sort of sector. There are other sectors. Financial services, for example, have been frustrated for years that they don't have as much access within the single European market as some other things. There are still regulations that are getting in the way. They say we may as well be out, right? There are others. So depends on that. There's also a left Brexit. And Jeremy Corbyn is part, you know, that's where his head is, which is the European Union has set up, right? Remember I said Margaret Thatcher was a big architect of a lot of the particularly the economic aspects, right? Has set up a free market system that is good for businesses and bad for human beings, right? From that perspective, which says because of European Union regulations, we have had to make things accessible that we shouldn't have to, right? And things like the creeping privatization of the National Health Service, right? Which maybe would have happened anyway under successive Conservative governments, maybe not, right? But you can look at the European Union as facilitating that, right? Make it harder to renationalize, harder to provide state aid. There's very strong laws in the EU on state aid, right? But if you want to promote a particular sector, right? So a Corbyn government might want to come in and say, we want to build up a steel industry again, right? And we're going to provide subsidies to do that. Right? Well, they can't do that in the European Union, right? So there's also that, left Brexit, which says these regulations stop us doing what we want, right? And so beyond that sort of nostalgia thing, or we want our blue passports back, or, you know, we want nasty-tasting sausages, whatever it is, right? And people have all sorts of totems, right? But there are some hard-nosed kind of calculations you can make on either end of the political spectrum which would say, actually, we might be better off without this, right? Now, most of the analyses say these are not well-founded, but there are good, you know, it's not entirely irrational at all.
Joshua, freshman, and well, this, first of all, this is a question for Professor Webb, and it's not a directly Brexit-related question, and you pointed out that the problem with the so-called fake news and printed media, and it seems like it exists everywhere in the UK, here in the United States, and in my home country, South Korea too. So I'm curious that how the people of the United Kingdom deal with this issue. Is there any law or regulation that can work as brake pedal?
If I could solve that problem, I would desperately wish to solve that problem. There are a few things. As I've mentioned already, broadcast media is more regulated than print media in the UK. And that does mean they have to be a little more responsible, particularly on the factual programming. So there have been some attempts in the past few years to introduce some media regulation. There's a voluntary scheme that a few media organizations have signed up to, which allows people to bring complaints, and there's a panel that adjudicates. And so that's a sort of voluntary mechanism, but it hasn't actually hit most publications haven't joined up to that and don't agree with that approach. Libel laws are aggressive in the United Kingdom, so individuals or corporations can bring libel suits and can put a paper out of business if they're sufficiently successful. So that's a sort of mechanism for at least putting some limits on what will get printed. But broadly across across printed media in the UK, there is a strong resistance to anything that looks like censorship, and there's good reasons to be resistant to censorship, which is why a lot of them don't like these regulatory moves and don't sign up to the voluntary ones. And I think a lot of it then comes down to changing the culture, right? Changing what people expect from their newspapers. But I don't know, I mean, comparison of other countries you're familiar with, is...
It's very similar everywhere. Actually, I did my dissertation about the comparison between the British news media coverage and the French news media coverage on the 2004 European Union enlargement, the Big Bang enlargement. And the French newspapers were also similarly alarming about the influx of immigrants that will... invade our countries and take away our jobs. Polish plumber has become a thing in France especially. And then we held the French referendum on the Constitution and European Union Convention for the Future of Europe. And there the French people voted no. To the treaty change, treaty reform. So it is really everywhere. The citizens themselves need to be really well informed, well educated, and if the media cannot do it, I mean, maybe go to the source of the story and be your own independent journalist for yourself. But at this day and age where social media is so prevalent you have news that are sent to you through push notifications, that you have this laziness about going out there and, your willingness to go out there and search for the truth. I do that, but how many of us do that is really questionable.
Particularly when we're also exhausted, right? So that exhaustion thing, it's I'm not being flippant. It is a real political phenomenon we need to wrestle with. It has a lot of implications, right? Including in how people get their information, where they get it, those things.
Hello, my name is Sean. I'm a sophomore here. It's my understanding that Britain has always historically been one of the more Eurosceptic members of the EU. And so they've recognized the economic downside of Brexit. But with that in mind and with the messy precedent they're setting, it doesn't appear that other Eurosceptic countries like Hungary or Poland will even be able to leave the European Union because their economies depend so heavily on the free trade. So my question is, without Britain as a sort of a Eurosceptic counterbalance, what are the implications for other Eurosceptic countries within the EU?
I will give it a go. So, Britain is normally, as you correctly pointed out, traditionally a Eurosceptic country, we have seen a track record of opting out of main integration projects within the European Union. And we have other usual suspects in the list as well. For instance, Sweden is known to be a Eurosceptic country when it comes to further integration. Denmark, to a certain extent, the same way. And we have other countries that are really going the different direction with the rise of far right and, very anti-European Union, anti-integration movement. With the withdrawal of the UK from the EU, UK is normally a very pro-widening type of a country in order to, for the most part, escape the pro-deepening camp within the European Union. So if you continue to add more countries into the European Union, you will not have to, act quickly and further deepen your integration within the European Union. So with their departure from the European Union, some anticipate further deepening, further integration within the, especially with the efforts of France and Germany together. But then, as you mentioned, there are certain other trends that go counter to this desire to have further deepening. So I think that it all depends on how these political movements will survive, I think, within their respective countries. So the electorates will decide on that, I think.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I mean, under the existing arrangements, Britain had been and had seen itself as allying with countries that didn't want to have so much European regulation. Actually, there tends to be the European periphery, if you will, the ones that have national churches, Protestant countries that had always been somewhat outside the, you know, European core, fit this pattern. So, you know, the Danes, for instance, are another group, and then the Norwegians stayed out of Europe. So those would give you some examples. But with the system of voting, having a big country, of which there were four big ones, you know, France, Germany, Britain, and Italy, if Britain was on board, it was very difficult to get something passed if one of the big four was against it. So this would put them in a more awkward position. But in a sense, every European country is awkward about its own things. I mean, Britain had the opt-out on the single currency, but so do the Danes, and the Swedes are out of that as well. Ireland had had an opt-out on abortion. France had an opt-out on running a sort of neo-colonial currency policy in West Africa. The Italians were keeping male members of the House of Savoy out of Italy because that was the old royal family. So everyone has their own little peculiarities, of which, you know, the British certainly had a high number of them. But everyone would look to have some sort of exemption from the standard European rules, but some more than others.
So I was wondering, it seems to me that the Irish backstop was slightly more prevalent in the media as the primary issue during Theresa May's prime ministership, and now since Boris Johnson has so much more of a chaotic sort of leadership style, and part of his strategy is to sort of make the EU leaders think that he would be more comfortable with a no-deal scenario, that the backstop has slightly faded from the front of the media coverage. But I was just wondering, to what extent is there still, like, a real concern about a return of violence to the Irish border, like, in terms of, again, during May's prime ministership, like, there were things about an IRA revival or more, I understand the logistical issues with having a hard border, but is there a real possibility of actual violence again, and how is that being addressed?
Yes, I was reading a study that did interviews with both sides, and both sides are seriously concerned about the possibility of returning to the violence that were observed during the Troubles. And the Good Friday Agreement itself is based on power sharing and, the possibility of, free, movement across the border. And now with the hard border, it is going to be a major difficulty. There are about 30,000 to 35,000 people that cross that border every time, and there are serious concerns that some will want to reunite, unite with Ireland, and others will start attacks against them, and so there are a lot of concerns about the renewal of violence.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, Theresa May, I think, quite sincerely wanted an agreement, and and she had a very fragile position, but I think she tried to play the hand she was dealt as well as she could, but I don't think there was a winning strategy there. But you get into lots of, as sort of alluded to in my talk, you get into lots of trouble if you start putting your national policy around what can get through Northern Ireland. because the communities there have very different ideas of their own identities. And if it becomes an issue of sovereignty, and that becomes the central feature, well, they have quite contrary views. And the European Union enabled them to paper it over. The Good Friday Agreement enabled them to, you know, settle a lot of that. And if there wasn't exhaustion, the Irish had been pretty exhausted by years of violence. But now it's, you know, what country you're a part of and sovereignty have been put right back front and center. And that is the fundamental issue for the Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland. And by putting it there, people are getting more radicalized, and you're starting to risk a return to the violence of before, which would then mean not only a hard border with the Republic, but also hard borders within Ireland. I mean, there were, you know, between Catholic and Protestant areas, they had their own wall. They're still there, but they were manned and armed by the British Army.
The Prime Minister sent a letter today, this afternoon, UK time, to the President of the European Commission, and the letter was published. It had some documents attached, which we haven't seen, proposing some new solution on Northern Ireland. But the letter, at least, was widely circulated. So far, what I've seen is that of the Northern Irish parties, only the Democratic Unionists support this proposal. So all the other Northern Irish parties do not like it. The Irish government essentially has a veto over this. The Commission, the other European Union members, will not agree to anything that Ireland is unhappy with. Right? That is absolutely primary for them. So the Irish Republic essentially has to be content with this. The proposal that the Prime Minister sent over said that proposed something that would be renewed every 4 years would have to be voted by the Stormont. The Stormont is the Northern Irish Assembly and Executive. It's been suspended for a long time now. It's not functioning, so how it could possibly agree to this is really not clear. And the President of the European Commission, in his public response to this letter and phone call he had with the Prime Minister, said, there are a few good things here, positive things, whatever. However, the President also noted there are still some problematic points. The delicate balance struck by the Good Friday Agreement must be preserved, right? That's for the European Union entities, the Commission that is the front line of negotiating, and for the other countries, that is absolutely front and center. And they will not, I think, agree to anything that they are not confident will preserve peace on that border, right? And it's obviously existential for the Irish Republic.
And in this regard, the backstop, how it comes about, matters greatly whether you're Protestant or Catholic. If it's a backstop that everyone has to agree to change, then the Protestants, the Democratic Unionist Party, are going to say, well, the Catholics will just hold it up and we'll be bound to the Irish Republic forever. Then we're not really part of the rest of the United Kingdom. But if after 4 years you have to vote to stay in and the Democratic Unionists will vote not to stay in, then the Catholics are going to say, well, then that means the default is we're out whether we want to or not. So you've prejudged the issue in a few years one way or the other. And if you have this delicate balance that you have now that people are happy with, then that's pretty good. But this will upset it one way or the other. And you could put it off 4 years, but whoever's, you know, it's going to default to someone's favor. No agreement's going to be beneficial to someone, and that'll set things off.
I have a question, something I don't hear much about in the news. They're talking about Britain leaving Brexit, not leaving Brexit. But I want to know what the effect is of Britain leaving Brexit on the United States. If they have to negotiate trade agreements with all the different little countries in the European Union, will the United States find itself a great new market in Great Britain? Because if you're going to have fuel shortages, food shortages, etc., we might be a supplier in a greater quantity than the European Union of these goods. So will the United States, in a sense, come out as a wee winner if they leave, or will it not affect us at all in trade?
That is an exceptionally complicated question. Fantastic.
Yes.
Who wants a crack at it?
Well, it sort of depends upon what trade agreement you negotiate. If you're the British, they have to gear up their army of trade negotiators, which hasn't existed for, you know, 45 years. Donald Trump has sort of made it clear that they want to get things like access to the British, you know, National Health Service and so on, which they may or may not get that, but Britain could see itself as being more vulnerable to pressure from the U.S. because it's just 60 million people as opposed to several hundred million in the EU. On the other hand, they could more carefully tailor the agreement with the U.S. in some of the areas that you talked about, like food. Britain doesn't really need to protect an agricultural sector, so they could, you know, let lots of American farm products in relatively inexpensively and maybe get access to something that the British, you know, that the Europeans had traded off against them. So that would be sort of an advantage they might see. But because Europe is so close and such a huge market, it's bigger, in fact, than the United States, Britain's going to trade more with them just simply based upon proximity than they would with us. In the same way, Canada will trade more with us than they trade with Britain. So there's probably a limited upside, also because we have quite extensive and deep trade relations with the European Union. They're one of our deepest trading partners as well. So I'm not entirely sure that terms would shift too much. But some industries, you know, American pharmaceuticals, healthcare, agriculture might benefit compared with where they were before. I think farmers in particular, that would always be an attractive area, I think, for the British, that was less attractive to, say, your French farmer or others who European negotiators would have to keep in mind.
Yeah. That's absolutely right. I think sector by sector is a different answer, right, depending which group you look at. I think there is a fairly large strategic downside for the United States. So if we move away from just trade to thinking about more broadly what the United States' interests are with the European Union and with the UK in or out, the UK has long been the closest friend to the United States inside the European Union. And so any time the US has had to do business with the European Union, they've been able to count on the United Kingdom being a receptive ear, usually an advocate, or at least someone who could, you know, if not advocate for US interests, at least understand what US interests are and often push for them, right? So with the UK outside, you no longer have that, right? The United States doesn't have their best friend, right, anymore part of the European Union. So the extent that the US wants to deal with the EU, and it really does on all sorts of issues, right, they've just lost a big voice if the UK walks out. So there could be some upside. Pharmaceuticals, absolutely. Agriculture, a few others. But I think also in that strategic relationship, there's a potential, in diplomacy, in security cooperation, in those kind of things, where the US-UK relationship has helped anchor the US-EU relationship, I think we could actually see some downside as well.
Just thinking of something more general, but I'll go with something a little more specific. We haven't really talked at all about Scotland's role in all this. They're so anti-Brexit. I suppose that's because it's in their self-interest to be against Brexit and to suffer as a result of Brexit. Let's think about what's going to happen to Scotland and to the United Kingdom in the presence of a no-deal Brexit or perhaps even any other type.
You addressed it a little bit, so.
Yeah. Well, and the Scottish had a referendum in 2014. The Nationalists had won, and and David Cameron sort of was compelled in that case because a parliament had been elected in Scotland that wanted independence, and they won that election. But in part, they were saying, well, if Scotland leaves the UK, no guarantees you're part of the European Union. You're going to have to negotiate your way back in, you fractious mountain people. And And they sort of narrowly carried the vote. But the Scottish nationalists are turning around and saying, well, okay, we voted to stay in the UK, but a UK that was part of the EU, and we voted pretty overwhelmingly everywhere in Scotland to stay in. And if you're going to let, and if you're going to be saying all these nice things about Northern Ireland needing to democratically decide what part of, you know, they're going to be in, what about Scotland? We democratically decided we wanted to stay in the EU, and the only way to guarantee that, say, so the nationalists will say, is to go independent. And this will, instead of having settled the issue for a generation, it will revisit the issue, and revisit it on top of having demonstrated that you'll go along with referendums, that breaking things apart that have been longstanding is an okay thing to do. So I think it opens up a whole can of worms for Scotland. Now, whether or not they might want to do that in the end, I don't know. But I think for the nationalists, at least, that's the argument they're going to make. And they've been, pretty strong. And then any agreement London comes up with on trade that's not to the benefit of Scotland, they're going to turn around and say, well, you know, look, just because we're not running our affairs, they're giving some agreement on petrochemicals that are giving Texas oil companies access to Scottish resources and so forth. So you can see how this can be turned on its head. The same arguments that had been used for Brexit could be used for a Scottish independence.
And also it matters whether the next prime minister or this one, we don't know who will be in power, will be able to allow for another referendum to take place as well. Because Theresa May said that she wouldn't allow for a second referendum after the Brexit referendum outcome. So,
This concludes tonight's event. Please join me in thanking the panelists.